This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ربيون كثير فما وهنوا لما أصابهم في سبيل الله وما ضعفوا وما استكانوا والله يحب وما كان قولهم إلا أن قالوا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا إسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Israel's attack on Iran's consular building in Damascus is the result of the irreparable defeats it has suffered in Gaza. Iran urges the UN Security Council to strongly condemn Israel's attack on its consular building in Syria, calling for an urgent meeting of the regime's violation. And Israel's indiscriminate strikes kill several foreign aid workers in Gaza, as the death toll from the regime's genocide nears 32,850. Thanks for joining us. Seven people have been confirmed killed in Israel's Friday airstrike on the Iranian consulate in the Syrian capital, Damascus. According to Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the dead include two senior Iranian military personnel who were on an advisory mission to Syria, as well as five of their accompanying officers. Meanwhile, Iran's Supreme National Security Council held an emergency meeting after the Israeli attack on the consular section of the Iranian embassy. The council said appropriate decisions were taken over what it called another Israeli war crime against people enjoying diplomatic immunity. Tehran also called for a U.S. Security Council meeting on the Israeli aggression. According to Russia's U.N. envoy, the Security Council will hold an emergency meeting later on Tuesday to discuss the Israeli attack on Iran's consulate in Damascus. The attack has violated international law, the 1961 Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations. Political commentator Tim Anderson earlier joined us with his take on Israel's airstrike on the Iranian consulate in Syria.
It's not unique. There are a number of Iranian advisors who have been targeted and assassinated by the Israelis in recent months. And I think it's part of a concerted plan by the Netanyahu regime to try and provoke Iran. And it poses a dilemma because, of course, what the Israelis are looking for is an escalation which may help draw the U.S. into a war, because, of course, the Israelis can't take on Iran by themselves. This is not the first provocation. There's a number of murders that have been carried out by the Israelis, and really, I think the anger amongst people around the world is really seething at the number of Palestinians they're killing, but also Syrians, Iranians, willy-nilly, the aid workers, journalists, you know. So I think this is a particular provocation aimed at Iran to try and get escalation. Really, the Israelis are unique in the region of wanting escalation because they're feeling more and more isolated.
The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Israel attacked Iran's consular mission in Damascus out of desperation caused by the irreparable defeats that it has recently suffered. The IRGC says Palestinians in Gaza and the resistance in the region have dealt heavy blows to Israel. Regional resistance groups also condemned the attack. Hamas called it a dangerous escalation and a blatant violation of both Iran and Syria's sovereignty. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad described it as a cowardly act and an attempt to distract from the regime's failures in Gaza. Lebanon's Hezbollah vowed that Israel's crime will not go unpunished. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine also stressed that the attack could not have happened without a green light from the U.S. Several countries, including Iraq, Pakistan, Oman, Qatar, the UAE, and Saudi Arabia and Russia, also denounced the Israeli aggression as unacceptable. Hossein Akbari, Iran's ambassador to Syria, has vowed that the Islamic Republic will give a decisive response to Israel's attack on its consulate in Damascus.
Two of the police forces of the Syrian government also got wounded in the operation. They were taken to a hospital. A number of cars were set ablaze. Part of the walls and premises, the main premise of the building of the embassy collapsed. The Zionist crime is nothing surprising. For more than 6 months, the Zionists are committing any kinds of crimes they can commit. Crimes against children, women in Gaza and the West Bank and Lebanon, even in Syria and elsewhere in the world. And insanely, Netanyahu is like a lone rider just committing crimes to protect himself and his position. And advocates of the Zionist regime, the U.S. and others, are also kind of complicit in these crimes. The Islamic Republic of Iran so far has stood against all these crimes, all this violence, and will definitely give the right response, as it has already given the right responses. The difference is that this time, maybe for the first time, the Zionist regime has allowed itself to hit an official building, the embassy premises of Iran, where the flag of the Islamic Republic is hoisted atop it. So this is the difference in this attack this time, and that's the crime that the Zionists have admitted to having committed. So this is the job of the international circle and those of the advocates of the Zionist regime. They need to be accountable. So the Islamic Republic of Iran, too, will reciprocate and in due time will take the right action.
The Iranian foreign minister has called for an immediate and appropriate response by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation to the Israeli terrorist attack on Iran's consular mission in Damascus. Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the call in a phone conversation with the OIC Secretary General. The Iranian foreign minister said that the attack violated all international laws. For his part, Hussein Brahim Taha pointed to Israel's criminal history and strongly condemned the airstrikes. Iran has also called on the U.S. Security Council to condemn the Israeli attack in the strongest possible terms and hold an urgent meeting to address the violation. Iran's foreign ministry also summoned the Swiss ambassador, which represents U.S. interests in Tehran. Amir Abdollahian said an important message was relayed to Washington as the main supporter of the Israeli regime. He said the U.S. must answer for the crime. Scores more Palestinians are killed in Gaza as the U.S.-Israeli genocide in the besieged strip approaches the grim six-month milestone. In the central city of Deir al-Balah, Israeli forces targeted a vehicle owned by the food aid agency World Central Kitchen. Seven foreign aid workers and their Palestinian driver were killed. The Hamas resistance movement strongly condemned the attack as part of Israel's policy of systematically killing unarmed civilians and international relief teams. Elsewhere in Deir al-Balah, the regime bombed the mosque, which claimed the life of a child and injured 20 other people. To the south of the strip, Israeli bombardment and shelling of Rafah and Khan Yunis claimed more than a dozen civilian lives. Since the beginning of the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza on October 7, more than 32,800 people have been killed and some 75,400 injured. Let's bring in Muti Abu Musaba, correspondent from Deir al-Balah, to give us the latest on what's going on in the Gaza Strip. Muti, we talked about this World Central Kitchen and how it's a U.S. aid-based aid agency. Tell us about that and, of course, all the other developments that you have for us when it comes to what has occurred in the past 24 hours or so.
Yes, actually, the Israeli occupation forces committed a flagrant crime over the last night when the Israeli warplanes attacked two two vehicles belong to the Central Kitchen, World Central Kitchen Organization. As you know, seven individuals working for that organization were reportedly killed over that attack, knowing that those cars were marked by the slogan of that organization. They were hit in the western part of Deir el-Balah city, in addition to a Palestinian driver. It's the first time for the IOF, for the Israeli occupation forces, to commit such a crime here in Deir el-Balah city, in the central area of Gaza Strip. There is no further details till this moment about this crime or the reasons the Israeli occupation forces killed those individuals and those foreigners for, knowing that they have international passports, including the as you know, the British, the Australian, and the Polish passports. They are foreigners working for that organization in order to aid the Palestinian people amid these catastrophic and dreadful humanitarian conditions the people are living in the Gaza Strip. As you know, that the central area of Gaza Strip accepts roughly 700,000 Palestinian evacuees who are taking shelter in the city amid catastrophic humanitarian conditions. And knowing that the international organizations working here in Deir el-Balah city or in the central area of Gaza Strip, or even at the level of the entire Gaza Strip, are limited. As you know, the Israeli occupation forces are fighting any humanitarian aid to the Palestinian people. So it's another crime committed against those individuals, and it is another crime added to the continuous Israeli crimes committed left and center against the Palestinian people, particularly when it comes to using starvation as a weapon of war against the Palestinian people. In the meantime, the Israeli attacks were maintained over the last night here in Deir el-Balah city as well. Another Israeli airstrike targeted Al-Bashir Mosque, which is located in Al-Hikr town. Al-Hikr town is known as one of the most densely populated areas in Deir el-Balah city. And it has been subjected to different and to relentless airstrikes over the last couple of months. So we are talking about another crime. At least 20 Palestinian civilians were reportedly injured, in addition to a Palestinian baby who was killed over that attack. While on the other hand, when it comes to the northern part of the central area of Gaza Strip, that area witnessed fierce clashes between the Palestinian resistance and the Israeli occupation forces, as the Israeli occupation forces maintained their artillery shelling against that area. I mean Al-Mughraga town and even Al-Amal, Al-Aman town, which is located in the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. While when it comes to Gaza City, more residential buildings were destroyed by the Israeli warplanes, particularly in Ad-Daraj neighborhood. Another residential building was hit and destroyed in that area, while in Rafah also the Israeli warplanes continued their airstrikes against the city. Another residential building was destroyed in Al-Barazil neighborhood. That area, as you know, it's overcrowded and overwhelmed with the people so far. Roughly six Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed, including women and children, in addition to dozens of the injuries. So the Israeli airstrikes are still continuing. These airstrikes are targeting either the Palestinian residential buildings on the ground and even the international humanitarian bodies that are working on the ground trying to alleviate the suffering of the Palestinian people.
Thank you very much for that. Moti Abu-Musabit there from Deir el-Balah. We appreciate it. Moti, be safe. Palestinians in the West Bank have been enduring intensified raids by Israel since the onset of the regime's war on Gaza. Israeli occupation forces have carried out fresh raids on towns, villages, and refugee camps across the occupied territories. The regime has stormed homes, made multiple arrests, wounding a number of Palestinians during these raids. Our correspondent from Ramallah, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with more updates.
The Israeli troops stormed several villages, East Qalqilya as well as South Qalqilya, like Jayus, Azun, and Habli, as well as Asli village, during the incursions to these villages, the Israeli troops stormed the Palestinians' homes, confiscated belongings, caused damage within the houses, and arrested a number of Palestinians. The Israeli troops had also stormed several areas around Al-Quds, like the refugee camp of Qalandia, for several hours. Exchange of fire have taken place between the Israeli forces and the residents of the refugee camp. The troops stormed the home of Mohammed Manasra, martyr Mohammed Manasra. He carried out an anti-Israeli operation in near the settlement of Aili, and he was shot and killed. Today, again, the Israeli forces stormed his home during this operation, and during the exchange of fire, a number of Palestinians had been wounded by the Israeli forces. At least seven Palestinians were arrested from Qalandia, a refugee camp. The Israeli troops in southern, the occupied West Bank, raided several towns in Al-Khalil area, raided the town of Beit Omar, and arrested at least one Palestinian, according to reports coming from Beit Omar. 14-year-old Palestinian was arrested by the Israeli forces. During the military raid to Qalandia refugee camp, the Israeli forces stormed Palestinians' homes and gathered dozens of Palestinian youths inside the refugee camp, interrogated them and questioned them.
Housing prices across the West have gotten so high that many people have given up on the idea of ever owning their home. Well, in Europe, protests are being held to demand more government intervention on the issue of building more affordable housing. Ramin Mazari has more from Paris.
In a statistic which may amaze and anger those in their 20s and 30s, in 1973, the average French person dedicated just 10% of their income to housing. In places like Lisbon, that figure is now 63%, as the housing situation across Europe is being called the worst it has been in 70 years. With winter prohibitions on evictions ending with the arrival of spring, protests are being held across Europe against the lack of affordable housing.
Houses are made for living in, and not for financial speculation. This is a fundamental truth which has been forgotten by successive French governments. They have turned their back on the many victims of our long-running housing crisis, and across Europe it's the same. What's worse is that they'll have many people evicted by landlords looking to cash out on tourist money for the Summer Olympics.
One out of four French people suffer from a serious housing problem, so it's no surprise that better housing has been a top issue for voters in election after election.
There's a real lack of decent, new, and safe housing in France and Europe, as much of our stock dates from after World War II. The laws requiring that 20% of lodgings be made available to lower-income citizens is not enforced, and we just don't see that the government cares about the incredible difficulty of finding affordable housing here in France.
In Paris, housing prices are up a back-breaking 70% since 2009, the start of the great financial crisis, and the failed response of far-right economic austerity. The hiking of interest rates in 2022 caused some housing markets in Europe to decline slightly, but others continued to rise. That also caused building costs to soar, reducing private construction. Housing groups insist that lodging issues could be fixed nationwide in just 5 to 10 years if the government's laws favored renters and regular citizens instead of landowners and real estate speculators. The primary culprit seems to lie in the refusal of right-wing economics to allow governments to invest tax revenue in building more affordable real estate, and also in the vast sell-offs to private corporations of government housing since the 1980s. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that is with this additional World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Years, 30 days. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors. Every faithful too, according to the extent that they had learned from the Ahlul Bayt, embarked on this heavy duty. So, the ulama that are Muslim scholars, took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job till the present day. Today, this duty has become highly important due to the broad assault of enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. Dear listeners, in this episode of this Ramadan series, we are going to focus on Ayah 104 of Surah An'am of the Noble Quran. This ayah is about insight and deep realization of religion and requirements of time and age. Stay tuned, please. The days of the blessed month of Ramadan are the best opportunity to contemplate on ourselves and the philosophy and meaning of life with regards to the circumstances of modern world. Definitely, improvement and perfection in every human aspect requires full awareness and information on the path to move in. God says in Ayah 104 of Surah An'am of the Noble Quran, "Certainly insights have come to you from your Lord, so whoever sees, it is to the benefit of his own soul, and whoever remains blind, it is to its detriment." Some of the great lexicographers of Arabic language believe that the word basirat, insight, is the belief of heart in a religious issue or a reality. Some others have described it as a smartness and admonition. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says in Nahjul Balagha, "Indeed, an insightful person is he who hears and thinks, looks and attains foresight, then is admonished, so moves in the clear path and avoids falling in precipice." If one is insightful, he will be able to see near and far in warrens, just as we should be careful not to fall in precipice and traps, and spiritual and social affairs too. We have to take care not to be deceived or go astray. Once a man called Ishaq ibn Ammar came to the 16th valuable successor of the Prophet, Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, and told him, "I have a neighbor who performs prayer a lot, helps the needy, and goes on Hajj pilgrimage very much. I have not seen any wrong from him. What kind of person is he in your opinion?" Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, asked him, "How is his insight?" The man answered, "He's not that aware and has no insight in religion." The Imam answered instantly, "So he will not gain high rank with these worships either." An insightful person can recognize various currents and encounter them vigilantly. He can discern the plots of enemies and choose his duty towards them. God says in the Quran that faith is the most important factor to attain insight. Insight is the means to differentiate between good and evil, between right and wrong. God-wariness strengthens insight and helps the person to act smartly and wakefully. He will thwart the plots of enemies. The father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had an exemplary insight due to his God-wariness. When he was on exile in Nofello Chateau, in the outskirts of Paris, he would not accept private meetings with various personalities, saying, "We have no private place." He used to hold meetings with several persons to witness the whole meeting so that no word would be decreased or increased to the talks. This is what today is happening through compound war and media war. This is called media literacy and considered as a part of insight. Therefore, insight is like having eye in confrontation of various events. Masoud Rajavi, head of the MKO terrorist grouplet, asked for a meeting with Ayatollah Beheshti, who was the judiciary chief in early 1980s. Ayatollah Beheshti accepted his request. Rajavi announced in a meeting that the MKO members were ready to pay allegiance with Ayatollah Beheshti, provided that he accepts their conditions. Martyr Beheshti told him, "Our difference with you is not a superficial difference. It is rather a deep difference originated in basic beliefs. My argument for you is that you don't even know Marxism." Then he read out part of Karl Marx's book, Capital, German, and translated it. He said to Rajavi, "If you refer to the original German book, you will notice that there are many fundamental mistakes in definition of Marx's economy. You have mixed principles under with the name of Islamic economy and Marxist economy and have found your ideology on this basis. This, while you should have recognized, acted, promoted, and explicated Islam according to its own principles." This very erroneous perception of Islam caused MKO terrorists to murder over 17,000 innocent people in terrorist operations, most of whom were ordinary men, women, and children. One of the most indelible stains in the MKO record was the terrorist blast in which Ayatollah Beheshti and over 70 of the companions of Imam Khomeini were martyred. The more one reflects on the ayahs of the Quran and the statements of the Prophet and his infallible progeny, the more he or she will gain insight and the power to analyze events and conditions. We are duty-bound to think deeply on various events and affairs. This will help us to come to a clear conclusion instead of being trapped in hollow and poor analysis. Weak analysis has been the pitfall of many societies and personalities throughout history. Zulkela was among the companions of Imam Ali, peace upon him, but owing to lack of insight, he was deviated and joined Muawiyah's camp and then became one of his commanders. Although he was fighting in front of falsehood, he thought that he was struggling for God and defending truth. Seeing the Prophet's loyal companion, Ammar Yasir, Zulkela remembered the words of the Prophet when he said, "Ammar will be killed by a rebellious lot." This was going to shake him, and that of the many of the deceived forces in Muawiyah's camp, as they could see Ammar on the other side. When Muawiyah noticed this hesitation among his camp, he immediately answered Zulkela, "Who knows whether Ammar will stay with Ali and not join us?" Lack of insight and deep ignorance caused Zulkela to be convinced and stay with the rebel, Muawiyah. He was killed. Ammar was martyred after him to clarify the truthfulness of the Prophet and rightfulness of Imam Ali and his companions. Muawiyah was happy as Zulkela was killed before Ammar because he knew well that had he seen Ammar's martyrdom, half of the Muawiyah's troops would have joined Imam Ali. This is ignorance and stupidity which extinguishes the light of insight.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. One of the biggest responsibilities that Muslims have been endowed with has been to propagate Islam and spread awareness about the causes that are most important to the Muslims. It's also amplified by the fact that the world is under the spell of the Zionist-owned and controlled media empire, which is uniquely hostile to Muslims and Islam. Evidenced by their shameful coverage of the genocide in Gaza and other issues related to Islam. In this week's episode, we will explore what the responsibilities of Muslims are in propagating the religion, defending the Muslims and Islam with the tongue, and clarifying the falsehoods of the global media. First, we take a look at what the religion of Islam says about these matters in the holy texts of the religion.
The religion of Islam is and has been from its conception a fast-growing religion. One of the reasons for that has been the focus on propagating the religion or performing dawah, literally calling others to the straight path. It is also a religion that calls on its followers to correct misconceptions and falsehoods, as well as enjoying the good and forbidding the evil. First, we can go to the Holy Quran to learn what Islam says about propagating the religion to others. In Surah 41, Ayah 33, Allah Ta'ala says, "Who is better in speech than one who calls to Allah, does righteous deeds, and says, 'Indeed, I am amongst the Muslims'?" In Surah 16, Ayah 125, Allah also says, "Call to the way of your Lord with wisdom and good preaching." Thus, it is a direct command from God that believers must propagate the religion of Islam, wherever they are, and must do so with the best of manners and etiquette. Allah Ta'ala also instructs the believers to enjoin the good and forbid the evil. "You are the best nation raised up for humankind. You enjoin righteousness, forbid corruption, and you believe in Allah." This concept of calling others to the right path and calling out wrong behavior or ideas is also found in a famous hadith of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, who says, "Whoever of you sees wrong being committed, let him rectify it with his hand. If he is unable, then with his tongue, and if he is unable, then with his heart. And this is the weakest of faith." And this is a theme which has been explored in a recent book released by the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, entitled Jihad al-Tabiyin. This means the struggle against misconceptions, which, as he points out, is even more important a duty on Muslims in an age where social media and the mainstream media spread such damaging lies about Muslims, as well as others who find themselves in the firing line of the global Zionism and its Western government puppets.
To discuss this important topic are two very special guests. We're honoured to welcome Dr. Reza John Vadadi, who is a multiple award-winning filmmaker based in London. Over the past 12 years, Dr. Vadadi has directed, produced and filmed over 50 documentaries that delve into the West Asian Muslim identity and culture, and he has also presented academic papers at numerous institutions across the world. Also joining us is the esteemed Sister Sahar Jaber. Sahar has an honours degree in Sociology and Communication Studies from McMaster University. She resides in Lebanon, where she studies at the Islamic Seminary. She co-founded Figs and Olives Publications, an Islamic publishing house aiming to provide reliable and impactful resources for parents, institutions and children in English. Assalamu alaikum to you both. Thank you for joining us on the show. Sister Jaber, if I could begin with you. We just saw in the video at the top of the show some of the verses that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has revealed for the Muslims to understand their duties in propagating the religion of Islam. What are your thoughts, first of all, on some of those verses that Allah has revealed?
I think those verses stress on the idea, in fact, that the prophets themselves, their main role in this world was to propagate Islam. That's the very essence and the purpose of a prophet himself. And so what Allah does is he does not stop at the prophet. It is not possible that the prophet was the last one to propagate Islam and then we should continue in our ways. What Allah asks from us is for us ourselves to propagate Islam. Inni ja'alna fil ardi khalifa. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. And so understanding this verse is that we have a responsibility in ourselves to be a representation for Allah, to be a representation on this earth in the way of God. A lot of individuals in this day and age, especially because of the society we're in, the feminine society we're in, they're very afraid to put on their beliefs or what they actually think would be true to others because they don't want to enforce anything. They don't want to enforce any religion. But Islam itself says you need to propagate in the way of your actions, propagate Islam, because that's the very essence of your purpose. What's to be a khalifa? What's to be a representation of God?
Absolutely. And there was another a hadith actually that we touched upon in that video, which is the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam saying that Muslims, if they see a wrong, they should correct it by their hand if they can, and if not by their tongue, and if not then at least oppose it in their hearts, which of course is the lowest form of belief. What do you think are the duties of Muslims when it comes to enjoining the good and forbidding the evil?
When we talk about forbidding the evil and enjoining the good, the reason why there's different levels is because if you can do it by tongue, it's the best, of course, to speak. But however, we know in this day and age, sometimes someone cannot accept and maybe even they will put some force on you in a way in which is unacceptable. And so at that manner, enjoining good and forbidding evil will even go towards your eyesight. And so in a way in which you do not show them that you are smiling or that you excel or accept what they're saying. Imam Jafar al-Sadi even says, call the people towards Islam without using your tongue, to the point in which your very representation in the workforce, in the community, it's a representation of what it means to be a Muslim, and in force, people are then questioning about Islam. We see, for instance, in Gaza, right now what's happening. So many are converting to Islam because they are seeing, not by words, not by the tongue, but by the actions, what it means to be a Muslim, and they are being introduced to it in a beautiful way.
Absolutely. Dr. Vadadi as well, I would maybe pick up the same point with yourself. Anything to add on that?
I think also one thing I always thought about is those people who are Muslim, from the Muslim Ummah, from the Muslim community, and they don't have the connection to what we're discussing in the sense that sometimes they accept injustice. I think sometimes we have to remember that injustice starts in the heart, and so we need to reevaluate. That's why it goes, if you can't do it by tongue, by hand, by tongue, then the heart, because it initiates in the heart. If your heart is not purely against oppression, doesn't matter what your tongue says, it emanates from the heart. So that's why it's important that we go back to the root, being the heart. And those who are not emanating against oppression, they need to reevaluate their connection with Islam and Allah, that something is not correct in their heart.
And if I can say with you, Doctor, you know, you're a media professional, you're somebody who has vast experience over decades. I want to get your thoughts in terms of the global media. How, you know, we know that they are controlled by Zionists, or those who are sympathetic to Zionists, or funded by Zionist capital. How do they use that media to defame Muslims and Islam?
So there's various tactics used by media to defame any group. If we look at the Muslim, they use a lot of tactics, for example, stereotyping and generalizing Muslim activities and lumping it with small number of people that may be doing something that's wrong or inaccurate towards Islam. Then they start, one thing they use is framing. So they frame Muslims in a specific way. They use military language when they describe Muslims. So it's a jihad when terrorist act happens and it happens to be a Muslim, but it's a lone wolf or a crime when it's a non-Muslim. They use divisive to them and us. They don't accept our values. They don't. When they come to this country, they don't. They want to impose their Sharia onto us. It's them and us. So, and there's also political motivations behind this. It's not. So people always say just Zionism. I think Zionism is one of the puzzles in the jigsaw of anti-Muslim. So capitalism is also part of that. Because what Islam says is promote justice, and justice is everyone having a fair share in the society they live in. But capitalism is about enriching a small number of people, and the concept of Zionism falls into that. It's used to bring a certain group of people down, unfortunately Palestine, but also used outside.
And it's interesting because, you know, in recent years we have got even more amplified because you've got social media now, so there's people receiving their news or the information in their phones. But we see the same pattern repeating in terms of, you know, social media companies, big tech companies kind of closing down on people or clamping down on censoring voices. Would you agree?
So this concept goes back to, for example, what Noam Chomsky, the professor from America, said, that they manufacture consent. Mm. So before social media in the last 15 years became really popular, they would use it through newspapers and then TV, cinema, radio. And now we have those, but then on top of that, we have social media, which is the one people more engage with more. And we know from many articles and news that came out that the American government is directly in contact with all the major
tech companies,
so yeah. Facebook, Instagram, to the point where FBI would give them requests to remove these accounts or shut down people who use these hashtags and so forth and so on. Mm. And we know all of us, I think all of us who watch this program would have realized now, since what happened from September the 7th, a lot of accounts have become shadow banned. Mm. So you go in, you see a post that they've put on and you want to share it, you can't. The option of sharing that account is not possible because the enforcement by anti-Muslim groups has become so powerful that a lot of accounts have been impacted by now. So social media maybe supposed to be a democratic platform.
It's definitely more decentralized. But people have more voice. Especially as you said, since October the 7th, it has been a case where we've seen the media companies try to control it more. But still, you know, the pro-Palestinian element does get through. Now, Ayan Islam spoke to people in London to ask them their thoughts on the responsibilities that believers have when it comes to these matters.
Okay, it's important and you can practice it in your day-to-day life, and you will do it by the people you speak to, through your actions, through your behavior, how you present yourself. Obviously, as for myself as a Muslim, I wear the hijab, and how I carry myself in public, how I speak to my colleagues, my friends, even strangers in public, even people on the tube who might be watching what I do, all of that is a part of that, and it will show it's combating how others might see us, and I think it is important. It's done that and that way, little bit by bit every day.
Yes, during this time, it's really important to do Jihad al-Tabyeen and to speak up, especially with what's happening in Gaza and the genocide and everything that's being committed. So yes, we do have to speak up more than ever.
I think Jihad al-Tabyeen arguably is more important for the everyday Muslim, even more so than, say, the important figures or the influential figures, because those people, the everyday person, is the one whom the non-Muslims get their impression of Islam from, and they form their idea of this is what the typical Muslim is. Arguably, that's one of our most important duties as Muslims in the West, and it's a very important opportunity we have is to bridge that gap to the non-Muslims. And historically, this was one of the most important forms of da'wah, for example.
The thing is, since 9/11, we thought we'd made a lot of inroads in terms of the media, in terms of representation, in terms of the media understanding our point of view and putting it forward. What we've recently seen with Gaza is that either that was a facade or it's been entirely rolled back, and there's been incredibly Islamophobic outpouring in the media, a very one-sided view, barely any sort of Muslim or Arab or Middle Eastern or Global South voices being expressed, except for example in Al Jazeera and for a handful of other places. A lot of journalists have been removed from their positions, like Mehdi Hassan famously. So it's been an incredibly difficult time, but it's also a time where we must fight back, where we must assert ourselves, assert our point of view, assert our narrative, and champion our cause. 100% is our Islamic duty, whether it's on a micro scale by informing your friends and family and by people that you know in your workplace, or whether it's on the political, on the macro level, whether we're joining political parties or joining political movements and joining protest movements and joining, you know, direct action causes where we're shutting down and blocking what's it called, weapons factories and so forth. It is definitely our duty, especially because I believe there's a hadith of the Prophet, forgive me if I misquote it, it is the duty of every believer he sees injustice to act upon it with their hands, and if they cannot do so with their mouths, then the lowest form of jihad is with their hearts. So certainly if we're able to, we must insert ourselves in all these spaces to push forward our points of view and to stand up for justice and human rights.
So it's just that, Jabal, we heard the opinions of some of the Muslim community there in terms of their responsibilities. But in terms of yourself, what do you think are our responsibilities in terms of clarifying, you know, misconceptions and lies that are pushed out by the global hegemony?
I think first and foremost, we have to understand that we have a responsibility in the first place. Many maybe assume that a sheikh or someone that's active on social media, they can take on this role. But in reality, it comes down to God chose for you a position in which you are in a geographic, cultural, systematic area for a reason, because you can have an influence in a way in which someone else cannot. They are not equal. And so to have and recognize that you have the influence in the first place is necessary. Then to understand that you have the language and the ability and the mechanism to do a form of Jihad al-Tabyeen in which other people cannot is necessary. And so in the media right now, with the misconceptions that are happening, this is no different than a time of Sayyida Zainab in which she was going and fixing the misconceptions that were happening against her son, against her brother, Imam Hussein. And we need to take on the misconceptions that are happening against us and be a leader and be a representative towards them. And so it is obligation of every Muslim. It is necessary for us to be an active role, to recognize our abilities, what we have to offer, and then on that basis, actually be an active member in society.
Absolutely.
And dealing with it.
And Brother Reza, yourself, what do you think are the responsibilities of Muslims? And also I'll go to the next question as part of that. Do you think Muslims are doing enough to fulfill those responsibilities?
I think there's always space to improve. We have started in the last 10, 20 years for Muslims to be active in various fields. So if we can break it down into, let's say, five, engaging within media, being participating in media, creating media content. We have a lot of Muslims who are active on social media, but we have some Muslims who are active in the mainstream media. So you have Mo Ammar, who did a show, and he, you know, he's proud to be a Palestinian in it. We had someone like Rami. Fortunately, some of the shows, like Rami's one, had some problematic elements to it, but you see more engagement. But it's not enough. There's still a need for it. There's the utilization of media. So we need people who are active, positive influences on social media, who don't sell out, if you know what I mean. That's very important. So if I can name a person, for example, I would say Sayed Hossein Makki. He's a very good influencer on social media. He sticks to his values, and he tries to avoid selling out to mainstream concepts. Community outreach. We used to do a lot of programs like Love Muhammad, which engaged with interfaith and intrafaith. There's also the mosques opening up during Ramadan. Maybe that could be something that happens more often, not just once a year, for example. And also education and media literacy. I personally participate in a lot of media literacy for our community, so then they can engage with their children. I think that's important, because we always think media is entertainment. We don't realize that ideology is embedded in media. So unless we can dissect it and take it apart, how do we explain it to our children, to our youth, and to others? So it's very important that we have media literacy as part of it.
I think one thing I always notice is, especially in the UK, but maybe in other parts of the West as well, is while the media is hostile, the culture, especially somewhere like London, is actually very pro-Muslim, because there are a lot of Muslims here, and on a micro level, there's a lot of micro-influencing. So you'll see, you know, non-Muslims who, all of their friends are Muslim in school, and they'll either accept the religion, or they'll be fasting in Ramadan in solidarity with their brothers and sisters or their friends. And so I think that's also as important as, like, the higher level kind of media work, is literally influencing your own people around you, your own communities, on a very, like, modular level. And Sister Sahab, just on a maybe slightly related topic, as a, obviously a sister and a student of knowledge as well in the Hausa, what do you think is a responsibility for sisters, for women especially, in these kind of responsibilities?
So I would take it upon myself. I never intended to be an active member on social media. I never wanted it. It wasn't something I was aiming for. But my husband and I, who is also an Islamic seminary, we both felt like it was a responsibility upon us to actually take this role, be active members, speak on truth, and actually represent Islam and the hijab in a way in which suits us. Right now, a lot of, as the brother said, a lot of Muslim influencers are sellouts, especially when it comes to females. They think that their role, they've lost purpose of the hijab, and they think their role as an influencer is to be someone that advertises clothing. But you have a bigger role to advertise what it means to be a woman in society, what it means to be a member of Zainabiyya, Fatimiyya. With women specifically, the reason in which their role and responsibility through the tongue is more important is because that's solely the role in which a woman can perform. She does not have the right to go by arms, and so her form of Shahadat Ibn is to go by tongue and to speak and to propagate, especially since a woman has the ability to speak eloquently in a way in which she can actually impact society more so than others. And so whether or not she's influencing those around her and her family members or in society, every woman has an active responsibility.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to stay with you as well, what would you say are some of the projects that you're involved in, or some of the kind of movements that you're involved in on this front?
So specifically on social media, on Instagram, that's definitely where I work the most in order to fix a lot of misconceptions that we have towards Islam, towards the hijab, towards femininity. Our book publication was literally created and manifested just for that reason. It was manifested because I was afraid, if I were to have a daughter, how would I teach her about the hijab in a society in which we'll call a woman a towel head or anything like that. So what's important for us is to actually understand that we have the ability to influence through our work in media.
And that's Figs and Olive Publications, right? Okay, we have to get that plug in there. And yourself, Dr. Vidadi, you're somebody that I've known for many years, and you've always been at the forefront. What are, just very quickly, some of the kind of projects and the work that you've done or are doing to this? And
things that I'd like to promote would be media literacy. So if anyone watched this and is interested in the community to engage in media literacy, so we can empower parents, we can empower individuals, and they can empower their children, which I think is always best, the parents educate their children. I'm happy to work with them. We have some events happening in April. I'm happy to do more. People interested in publishing, as Sister Saya said. Also, I'm thinking about bringing authors who've written interesting content, different worldview from the East, bringing it to the West. And also people who may be interested in films, film festivals, organizing. Al-Quds, we can have an Al-Quds International Film Festival that promotes the concepts of resistance to what's happening in imperialism. So these are things that I'm happy to engage with anyone who wants to reach out. They can use my name in social media. They'll find me, email me, and I'm happy to work with them.
And it's interesting that you say, or you talk about the importance of educating people about the media. I had a very young education. My older sister, when we were kids, used to tell me and point things out in movies. So, for example, we watched Back to the Future, and it was a very negative perception of Libyans and Arabs in the film. And very young, we must have been, I was seven, she was nine, and she said, look how they portray the Arabs in the film. So I had that education growing up. Not everyone might have that in the home. So it's good that you are doing that work for people to understand the agendas behind some of this mass media. And before we leave, I know that both of you have prepared small pieces of poetry. So I'll start with you, Dr. Vidadi, this to read perhaps a bit of poetry that is relevant to this topic.
So my poem is from a famous Iranian poet, Persian poet from the 13th century called Sa'di. And it touches on the heart that we discussed and caring about the Ummah in general. And he starts with, and this is on top of the UN building. Human beings are member of a whole in creation of one essence and soul. If one member is afflicted with pain, other members uneasy will remain. If you have no sympathy for human pain, the name of a human you cannot retain.
Thank you so much. And Sister Sahar.
So this poetry is off of Shahida bint Huda, who is the sister of Shahid al-Sadr. If it is said old-fashioned you are, care not and steadfastly continue to be. Say, I am the daughter of the message. From its light I get guidance. My shyness has not prevented me from the highs. It has not shackled my hands, no. And this veil hinders me not from my aim. O sister, the morrow is ours. Go on your path upwards. O sister, the truth rises above the cunning of the aggressors. And in short, this poetry really touches upon the idea that a woman, her shyness, her hayat, her modesty, these are all representation of propagation for a greater truth. And she is capable to do more than to follow what the Western forces her to believe she is.
Thank you so much for that poetry.